Coming up, payday loans. The government this week unveiled plans to regulate them. Lucky Severson last year reported on the harm they can do. Also, Kim Lawton on a Muslim congregation of and for women. And a church-turned-packing plant to help feed hungry children.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. More than 20 people were killed and dozens injured when two hospitals were hit in northern Syria this week. Witnesses said the airstrikes appeared to be conducted by Syrian government forces or their Russian allies. Hospitals have been a regular target throughout Syria's five-year civil war. International human rights groups say the attacks appear to be a way for government forces to punish civilians in rebel-held areas. The Syrian government says its attacks are aimed at terrorists. Germany's government overwhelmingly adopted a resolution declaring the killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks beginning in 1915 were genocide. The Turkish government angrily denounced the vote, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan recalled his ambassador to Germany for consultations. 11 of the European Union's 28 members have recognized the Armenian killings as genocide. Pope Francis has also referred to the killings as genocide, but President Obama has stopped short of using the word. Germany is home to an estimated 3 million people of Turkish descent. This week, the federal government's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau unveiled plans to regulate the controversial practice of payday loans. Many consumer advocates, including religious leaders, have long objected to these high-interest loans that can devastate a poor family, as Lucky Severson reported last year from Birmingham, Alabama.
Fight back!
Birmingham, Alabama. This is a demonstration against the state's payday lenders. You know, those stores that offer short-term loans at exorbitant rates, most often to poorer people who couldn't get loans from banks or credit unions.
Stop the scam!
There are nearly 1,000 in Alabama alone, four times as many as there are McDonald's, in a state that has the third highest poverty rate.
It's predatory lending. They're picking off the most vulnerable. They're stealing from the people who can least afford to be stolen from.
Reverend Shannon Webster is pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Birmingham. He is an outspoken critic of payday lenders.
Hello, Alabama.
Earlier this year, President Obama traveled to Birmingham to underscore his concern that payday lending is targeting and trapping the most vulnerable. He met with faith leaders, including Reverend Webster.
There's a moral and ethical injunctions starting back in the Old Testament, going all the way into the New Testament church. There are injunctions against lending at interest in exorbitant ways.
Payday lenders are not only an Alabama phenomenon. Nationwide, each year, about 12 million Americans spend more than $7 billion on payday loans. According to a study by the Pew Charitable Trusts, the average borrower takes out 8 loans of approximately $375 and spends $520 in interest. But few states are as saturated with these storefront lenders as Alabama. Carolyn Foster is with the Greater Birmingham Ministries.
You will find them in low-income areas, neighborhoods, where a person can just walk across the street and there will be 5 or 6 on one block sometimes. It sickens me to see them.
You can't see the Taco Bell for the Cash Express sign.
Sherry Saunders was 8 years in the military, attended college. She and her husband are unemployed, have 2 handicapped children. They survive on a $654 disability check and food stamps. and that they scavenge tin cans and scrap metal to get by.
My lights were being turned off. My water was already turned off. And I saw the flashing sign that you can pay back in 30 days.
That was 4 years ago. She borrowed $254, still owes that amount, and continues to make payments. She says she has paid $2,000 in interest so far.
They will not allow you to make partial payments. And if you can't make the full payment, then they initiate the process of coming and getting your goods, because it's a secured loan. So they want your lawnmower, your TV.
Sherry Saunders' loan was secured by collateral, by her possessions, like her truck. But most payday loans are secured with a post-dated check.
We see people all the time who come to our organizations in need of food, clothing, utility assistance, and if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that they are coming to us for those kind of services because they had to pay off the predatory loan first.
Borrow Smart Alabama is an umbrella group of about 300 payday lenders who contend that people are fortunate to have instant money available when they need it. Max Wood is a Borrow Smart president.
They don't want to bounce a check and pay $40. If they get their power turned off, it's going to cost them anywhere from $100 to $200 to get the power turned back on. They can come here and pay $17.50, and they walk out of here with $100. Or they can pay five times that much and walk out of here with $500.
There's a case to be made that the working poor are probably better money managers than those who are quite well off, precisely because they have to be, just to get by.
One common complaint is that when the payment is late, the lender can make life miserable.
And we do get references.
From their family.
From their family or whoever they give. But we use those simply to say, if we can't get directly in touch with the customer, then we'll call the family member and say, look, we need to talk with so-and-so.
In Alabama, payday lenders are restricted from charging more than 17.5% interest. But that's for the term of the loan, which is often only 2 weeks and rarely longer than 30 days. If the loan is not paid on time, the compounded interest annually can total more than 450%. Faith leaders and advocacy groups have petitioned the legislature to restrict the loan industry, but so far the lenders have the louder voice.
Not only the loudest voice, they have the loudest money. They have. I've said they have more money than God, and lobbyists too.
You have a lot of clout. You give money to a lot of the legislators, and you have a voice with them.
Well, we certainly, and they do as well.
We have a moral voice to bring to this discussion and to bring to this work. And so it is our calling as people of faith to step in, and as some scriptures say in the Christian tradition, to stand in the gap.
Wood says there's another argument in favor of payday stores, a 2013 study by Auburn University, that when these stores are forced out, there is an increase in petty larceny. One of the authors is Professor of Finance John Jehara.
How do we explain that? Well, it's somewhat speculation. It may mean that people get desperate for short-term money needs, and they do resort to petty larceny. They steal a TV, a computer to sell quickly to get the money.
But it's the awful place in which so many people, like Sherry Saunders, find themselves that concerns faith leaders.
As I was told, it is my responsibility to make sure I can pay my bills, and if I was any kind of mother, I would have.
One thing churches are pushing here and across the country is underwriting loans to enable borrowers to pay off all their payday obligations through a credit union. In Birmingham, it's called Lighten Up Loans Program. It was launched with a $25,000 grant. This is Titus Battle. He worked part-time as a dishwasher and has enrolled in college.
I was making $80 payments, and about 3 months into it, I realized that I wasn't paying anything toward the money that was borrowed.
With a Lighten Up Program, he can consolidate his loans and pay them off all in a year.
We cut a check to pay off the payday lender, and you're done with them.
Okay.
But across the U.S., programs like Lighten Up Loan face a daunting challenge. In Alabama alone, there are more than 300,000 people searching for instant loans every day.
The average loan is $300. Now then, tell me what impact they're going to make with $25,000.
It's only the beginning, supporters say, of an uphill battle, but one that an increasing number of faith leaders now see as a moral issue that they're willing to take on. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Birmingham.
St. Francis Xavier Cabrini Church was one of the more than 75 parishes the Archdiocese of Boston ordered closed in the wake of the clergy sex abuse crisis. Last Sunday, it celebrated its last Mass. About 100 diehard parishioners had kept the church open for more than 11 years by maintaining an around-the-clock vigil to protest the decision to close it. But earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the group's final appeal. At one point, 9 churches in the Boston area were occupied by parishioners. St. Francis Cabrini was the last holdout. Wildlife officials have begun removing some of the 137 tigers held at a Buddhist temple in Thailand. The monks in charge of the temple have been accused of illegal breeding and trafficking of animals. 40 dead tiger cub carcasses were found in a freezer at the temple. Thai police stopped a truck carrying tiger skins and other animal parts as it was leaving the site. 2 temple staffers in the truck were arrested and charged with possession of illegal wildlife. A monk traveling with them is expected to be defrocked. Tiger parts sell for thousands of dollars and are in high demand because of their use in traditional medicine. The tigers will be taken to 2 government animal centers elsewhere in Thailand. On our calendar, Muslims begin observing the holy month of Ramadan on Sunday evening. Muslims who are able to do so are called upon to fast every day from dawn to sunset and offer gifts to the poor. Muslims in Iran are expected to skip this year's Hajj pilgrimage. Saudi Arabia oversees the pilgrimage to Mecca by more than 2 million Muslims from around the world. Iran says the Saudis could not guarantee the safety of its citizens and is to blame. Saudi Arabia, in turn, accused Iran of depriving its citizens of an important religious duty. Hundreds of Iranians died in a crush in last year's Hajj. Iran boycotted the Hajj for 3 years after 402 pilgrims, mostly Iranians, died in clashes in Mecca in 1987. Among the world's 1.6 billion Muslims, it's apparent that almost all preachers and other leaders in mosques are male. But we had a story from Kim Lawton last year about a conspicuous new exception. A group of women in Los Angeles has organized the Women's Mosque of America.
In Los Angeles, it's just after noon on Friday, the day Muslims gather for their weekly Juma prayer service. But as the traditional call to prayer echoes, something very non-traditional is taking place. It's being given by a woman. This is the Women's Mosque of America, believed to be the first female-only mosque in the U.S. Here, women have all the leadership roles of the service and make up the entire congregation.
A woman's relationship to Islam is different than a man's relationship to Islam, and to have the space to talk about that and just have a space to be in that together, I mean, this is, I think it's like revolutionary, like this hasn't happened before.
American Muslim women say they can feel marginalized at worship services in traditional mosques. Only men are allowed to lead the prayers and preach the sermons. Women are usually seated in separate areas, often away from the main part of the sanctuary.
It's often either to the side or small, not well ventilated. Maybe visual access to the imam is not very good. In the United States, the mosque has been not, I'm just going to say, not an optimal space for Muslim women.
Professor Rukhaya Khan is chair of the master's program in Islamic studies at Claremont Graduate University. She says many U.S. mosques are still organized around the centuries-old cultural traditions of the immigrants who established them.
Generally, the mosque has been a male space, a gendered male. It wasn't that women weren't allowed to go to the mosque, but they weren't encouraged to go.
For some women, this has created a barrier to practicing their faith.
I didn't always feel comfortable because of the atmosphere being very much male-driven, and the community involvement is very much limited.
As several prominent Muslim women in Los Angeles discussed the problem, the idea emerged of creating a mosque exclusively for women. There are a few similar mosques in other parts of the world. The Women's Mosque of America launched earlier this year. Muslim activist Adina Lekovic is on the board.
Ultimately, the goal is to empower women with the message of the Quran and to increase their Quranic literacy so that they can go back and serve their co-ed mosques.
The Women's Mosque holds its Juma prayers at the Pico Union Project, an interfaith space that was founded as a synagogue. The female-only Juma services take place once a month and follow a traditional format, starting with the call to prayer.
I've never even thought that like a woman could give it. I haven't felt sad about that or oppressed or anything, but hearing it by women was amazing, and I felt it was really liberating. From the moment that I heard the call to prayer from the mouth of a woman, I was elevated in a whole new way. I felt a spiritual connection to God that I haven't felt that kind of jolt in a while.
The mosque has selected several prominent professionals from the community to deliver the khutbah or sermon. Topics have included social empowerment, environmentalism, and sex abuse.
What's really important is not just the fact that we have a woman at the pulpit, but she is invoking Islamic sources, using Islamic examples to make claims and arguments, to provide insights that are really attuned to the realities of these women's lives.
Layla Al-Mariati, an OBGYN doctor, was one of the preachers.
Every one of us reads the text through a different lens, from the perspective of where we are in our personal lives, historically. And women read the Quran differently than men do, and the verses will appeal to us in different ways. By not having women talking about it, you've eliminated half of your community and what their perspective could be.
Sometimes it's a different perspective, sometimes it's even the same perspective as if, as had a man given the khutbah or the sermon, but it's just so nice to hear. There's a certain relatability and there's a certain connection, I think, that I personally feel when I hear a fellow sister really giving us the khutbah.
After the service, there's a time where the women can discuss their reflections about the sermon or share their own experiences, something that likely would not happen in a co-ed setting. Many say they're spiritually enriched by it. Some who've been alienated from other mosques have been inspired to return to Friday services.
I honestly didn't really feel less Muslim because I wasn't going to the mosque. I didn't feel like I was less connected to God. I was missing that sense of community.
The Women's Mosque describes itself as an inclusive middle ground that welcomes people from all perspectives.
You can be conservative, you can be liberal, you can be secular, you can be whatever kind of person, whatever kind of follower you are, believer you are, and come as you are. There's no judgment, there's no policing of how you interpret your faith.
Within the broader American Muslim community, reactions to the Women's Mosque have been generally positive, but there has been some criticism. Some question whether it's appropriate for women to be taking such leadership roles. Professor Khan says there is nothing specifically in the Quran about the gender of those who may lead prayers, and she says other traditional Islamic texts do allow for women leading women.
They cannot lead mixed genders in prayer, but they can lead women in prayer. And the same goes for holding forth from the pulpit. They cannot sermonize a mixed gender congregation, certainly not an all-male congregation. However, they can all women.
Women have for a long time felt shut out from mosques everywhere. And so instead of trying to argue against whether this women's mosque should exist or not. They should really be looking at their own communities and wondering how they can make them a more welcoming place for everyone.
Other Muslim leaders have raised concerns about segregating a particular segment of their community. They worry that other groups could break away or that women could be encouraged to abandon local mosques altogether. Leaders of the Women's Mosque say it's just the opposite.
It was never intended to be an alternative. It's a complementary space for women to find their voices and then take that experience and then go back to co-ed mosques, go back to whatever institutions that they belong to and feel more empowered to use their voices.
Khan admits she too is troubled by the notion of a segregated mosque. But she also believes this could have a significant impact on the larger Islamic community.
What's really amazingly powerful is the reach beyond the physical space through the use of social media. So they've got Facebook, they've got Twitter, they've got YouTube.
Lekovic sees the Women's Mosque as a continuation of the legacy of Muslim women.
If we go back to the Quran, then it's our responsibility to step up. Instead of waiting for permission, we have to step outside of our comfort zone and take on new responsibilities that might be unfamiliar, uncomfortable, might challenge the norms, but that's good for us and good for the community and good for our relationship with God in the process.
And she says it's their responsibility to pass that legacy on to the next generation.
When I think today about my own daughter and that a women's mosque is just going to be normal in her life and in her vocabulary, that to me is overwhelming. And I think that that's really a testament to where we're at as a community and as a faith today.
I'm Kim Lawton in Los Angeles.
Televangelist Jan Crouch, who co-founded the Trinity Broadcasting Network, died this week just days after suffering a stroke. She was 78. Jan and her husband Paul Crouch launched the network in 1973. TBN says its programming is carried by over 5,000 television stations and bills itself as the world's largest Christian television network. Jan Crouch and her husband had been criticized for their lavish lifestyle, which included multiple homes, corporate jets, and $1,000 dinners. Many churches across the country have been helping the campaign Stop Hunger Now by packing non-perishable food for malnourished children around the world. We looked on last winter at the work of the Grace Community Church in Arlington, Virginia. In one morning, 1,500 people packaged meals for 100,000 children. Our host was Senior Pastor John Sly.
We focus on just three things at Grace: Christ, community, and compassion. And compassion for us is practical service, which is what we're doing here today. Gathered together 1,500 people to feed 100,000 hungry bodies.
Okay, that gong means that we have already packaged 7,000 meals. We are way ahead of schedule at this point.
The meals are comprised of four ingredients: a long grain white rice, soy protein, textured vegetable soy protein. We also have a dehydrated veggie mix: celery, carrot, onion, bell pepper, cabbage, and tomato. And then finally, and probably the most potent part of our meals, is a vitamin sachet pack, which has 21 different minerals, nutrients, and vitamins specifically tailored for malnourished children. And while all these ingredients are added together and cooked with water, it kind of tastes like a chicken rice-a-roni.
Most of those meals are going to go to schools or orphanages. We love the fact that many of them in the past have gone to schools because parents know there's a good meal for them at the school. They'll send the child to school to get the meal, and then they get the education.
Okay, we're up to 74,000.
What we tell people is to come out to this event, and instead of hearing a sermon in a traditional service, instead of hearing a sermon, they come here and be the sermon. This world is filled with so many problems that you almost don't know where to start. And for us, when you gather a bunch of people together, there's strength and there's encouragement in that. And so what we say here is together we can do more. So we gather a lot of people together so we can make a much bigger impact in a very practical way.
We are now up to 81,000 meals.
When you look at the biographies of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there's only one miracle of Jesus that's represented in all four biographies, and that's Jesus feeding hungry people, thousands and thousands of hungry people. So we think this event is so Jesus.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.